Welcome to episode 7 of the Frontal Harvest podcast.
A podcast about science, technology, and education. And
oh, wait, no, that's not right. We have the last one's notes. And what? We've got to come up with something quick.
Oh, what are we going to come up with? I assume that's what we're talking about. And pie.
And pie. That's perfect. Okay, I'm Patrick.
And I'm Kelly. And together, we host the Frontal Harvest podcast.
So let's get started. So we're recording this April 9th on Thursday to be put out on the 12th on Sunday. And we're trying a little bit of a different audio setup. I noticed on the last few that there was really large variations in the audio level, and I tried to fix it, and I haven't come up with a good way to do it yet. So, manual is just taking too long and it's not really working very well. So we'll see how this comes up. And I'll also try to see if there's not some filter or something that can do some type of a moving window adaptation for the sound volume. Because the problem was really the volume sometimes seems to be really high.
It spikes.
Well, it's more than just that. It seems like sometimes it looks like we talk louder, and other times we talk way too softly.
Okay.
So, not sure how to handle that yet.
We might have to learn a few things as well.
Might, yeah.
Okay.
So, blog entries first. I guess we'll do mine. This is one that I started writing a long time ago, called it Adventures in TQFP Land. Mm-hmm. So, I only finished it for my last entry, but most of the work was done quite a few months ago. I think you remember we got the thin quad flat package 18 mega 328Ps from, I think it was DigiKey, because it was in November or December.
Yes.
And we couldn't, and SparkFun, you could see the number of them disappearing.
Yeah.
As Christmas came over. And I mean, the idea, because they're so much smaller than the dual inline packages, the DIPs, is that we could build stuff that's smaller. And
we wanted smaller because we were hoping to use it for ARDF.
That's right. It was for the ARDF controllers.
Right. And it would have been a little smaller and more. We would be able to carry it easily.
Which is still the plan.
It is. Yeah. It's still the plan.
So, the big problem I found was not what I had expected. Soldering was actually pretty easy. We got some of those breakout boards from Adafruit.
Right.
And they worked like a charm. The problem is if you want to make your own circuit and you're doing it in-house, trying to make traces that are that small is really difficult.
Also, the soldering, you went to a liquid solder.
Oh, yeah, the paste.
And that made it a lot easier, the paste.
I really liked the paste the first time through.
And you could just use heat to put that in the areas that you would really like to have it.
Anyway, but I think the conclusion is that doing it by hand, making the board by hand for a TQFP is just out of the question. And that's what drove us to sending away for boards from Osh Park.
Yes.
Which is very cool.
Yeah, that was exciting.
Yeah. So that's another, like I put at the end, that's another blog entry because I'm tearing my hair out trying to figure out why those don't work. Mm-hmm. And I still don't know if I made a mistake in the circuit or if I destroyed the chip with heat or what, but so that'll be for future stuff. Anyway, but that's all I was going to, unless you have some questions about the TQFPs.
None that I can think of right now. I just wanted to mention the nice gel solder.
Yeah, that was really a discovery.
Good find.
Yeah,
and it was more accurate and precise than
definitely
the regular solder.
Yep. That's been on the back burner for a while. We've been so busy with the...
It has been.
Diomi and...
Right.
That we directed and all the other stuff.
So. And all the other crazy things that have gone on. Some of them we'll be talking about later. So I'll go over to my blog entry. And it's about our recent trip to Limville Gorge. And it was kind of our recompense after doing all the orienteering stuff and just wanting to run away for a weekend where we had an extra day off so that we could really enjoy some good hiking in an area that's further away from home.
I would even say our well-deserved recompense.
Yes, it was well-deserved.
Because we worked so hard for that.
We did. It was crazy. And we needed to because we had done it for the first time. So
yep.
No regrets there. So we went to Limville Gorge. And if you aren't from North Carolina, Limville Gorge is what they call a mini Grand Canyon. It's very small, but it is a canyon-type area. And you start at the top and you go down to a river.
Is it the largest canyon in the east U.S.?
I thought it was.
I think it might be.
I'm not sure. So that's why it's called the mini Grand Canyon of the east. It's a beautiful area, a huge wilderness area. So, you can go out in the woods and know that you can be really off on your own.
Yep.
There's a lot of trails. The trails are not well marked.
They're not marked.
Yeah. Well, that's true. They aren't marked. Well,
which
there's
is very
little
cool.
signs. Every once in a while, there's little signs.
There's a little sign here and there.
Yeah.
There's no blazes.
There's no blazes, but they do have little trail headers at the end of trails. And we were on the Spencer Trail one day, which took us down to Limville River. And our whole goal was to get to the river, cross the river, and go down the river to the mummy and the prow so we could have a better view of it. And that's a climbing project that we want to take on
this
in the future.
This has been an ongoing project, finding that place for, what, 3 years?
3 years, yeah. Never have we found the river, but we finally got to the river.
Yeah, we did finally get to the river.
Which was fun.
Well, the thing is, so to understand what this is all about, there's a place we really want to climb called the Prow. And we go down, there's no trails. We go down this gully and there's lots of bushwhacking, heavy brush because of fires that have taken out the trees, and then the brush has grown up really thick. And so when we're trying to go down to get to the Linville River, which is at the bottom of the canyon, really that's a secondary goal.
Mm-hmm.
Our first goal is finding out where the prow starts.
Exactly.
And I think we've gone down too far every time.
I think we have, which is weird.
Yeah.
Because we keep on thinking, no, we have to go further. And I think we have to realize that the starting is at a different...
Well, also, when we're there, we're not thinking of climbing.
No.
You know, we never brought anything for climbing. We're more into exploring mode. So
right.
It's hard not to... You see a certain area that's interesting, and you try to go that way. And
right.
I guess we know that gully... quite mm-hmm. well by after 3 years.
Oh, exactly.
Of going there.
So we went down the Spencer Trail. We ended up at the river and we got to see several beautiful campsites on mm-hmm. the way. And at the river, we were expecting to find a bridge, but the bridge was no longer up. In fact, it had been dismantled. And so we ended up just scrambling along the river, which was very beautiful. Huge rocks, wonderful views, and just a really interesting little scrambling area to move around. And the next day, we actually went for a hike over on the Pynchon Trail. And it's on the other side of the Limville River, coming in from James Lake area. And that was, well, we both decided we liked that side better as a hiking area. And it's a much steeper trail going down. It
It's interesting because on the Spencer Trail, you're going down a gully, while on the Pynchon Trail, you're going down a ridge.
Ridge, yeah.
So you're more exposed. So I think that's more interesting.
It's definitely incredible views.
Yeah.
All around. So you get to see the whole valley area. We could see the area that we want to climb. And it just gave us incredible views.
So Linville Gorge Trail goes along the Linville River at the bottom of the gorge.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes north-south.
Mm-hmm.
But it's on the west side of the river.
Right.
And as far as we can tell from that entire trip, we couldn't find any bridges across.
Nope.
Now, some people did manage to cross it. And it wouldn't be difficult to cross, but if you don't want to take your boots off...
Right.
I don't know about crossing the river.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think part of what made it also so much more interesting on the west is that you go down the trail and you're on, and you get to the Linville Trail. So you go down the Pynchon Trail.
Right.
Which is going east as mm-hmm. you drop into the canyon. And then you have this long trail. You can go up and down the river and check things out.
Right.
Well, on the east side, you go down, and there's nothing there because you can't get to the trail. It's on the wrong mm-hmm. side of the river. So your only thing is go up and down the river a bit, but pretty fast you end up situations that are not passable.
Right.
Close to the river, and which is serious bushwhacking.
Right. Limited options
yeah.
for easily moving up and down the yeah. river. And so, yeah, definitely made it.
So do you have some stats for technical part stuff?
Oh, okay. So if we're looking at the pitch...
How far were the hikes?
Okay. So the first day hike was approximately 7.4 kilometers. And down to the river and back out to the table.
So one of the things we did... was we did that thing I blogged about once about how we use GPS.
Right.
Where we marked a bunch of waypoints and stuff, but we didn't look at it while we were there.
Right.
So some of this information we're getting from our GPS track.
Right. Yeah. Where it's between the GPS track and my Fitbit.
Your Fitbit.
My Fitbit. Ooh. Also, you know, estimated about the same distance.
Right. Okay.
So it was a great comparison.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Now, the elevations we got from a USGS map. It was a National Geographic map.
Right. And we only did it for the one side because of the Pynchon Trail being along a ridge and being so steep.
Right.
We wanted to know the elevation change.
Okay.
It just...
I can get it from the other, I'm sure.
Yeah, we could. Because it wasn't as... dramatic.
Right.
For the other, we didn't look it up.
Right.
It was a little bit more of a rolling land.
Right.
So the first day, we did 7.4 kilometers, and the elevation change wasn't as drastic. It was much more, I don't know how to say it, but it wasn't as steep as the Pynchon Trail. The Pynchon Trail, we followed and we did 8.1 kilometers and the elevation change was 520 meters. So.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
That was big compared to the Spencer Trail.
Yeah. Do we know that it was big? Or is it just that, because if the slope, you know, how would...
Yeah, we would.
It might not be any different.
Yeah.
It's just very steep on the Pynchon Trail.
It's very steep. Like, you just go straight down, yeah. It seems, you do. You walk straight down for an hour and a half until you hit the leveled area right beside the river. And the Spencer Trail, it's much more gradual down to the river. So, both days, excellent weather.
Yep.
And, just at the time where we're starting to see some beautiful flowers, we had some trilliums that we got to see.
The red trilliums. I've never seen that. I actually don't know their names.
No, I don't know the scientific names for them. But
is that the common name for a red trillium?
I think so. That's what I grew up with.
Oh, okay. Just call it red trillium.
I'm not sure if it's, you know, one that's well known. We also had very little bud growth on the trees.
Yeah, not much.
Not much. And it's...
Lots of rhododendron.
Yes, lots of rhododendron. Nothing in bloom.
No. So the east and the west side seemed quite a bit different.
They did.
We're only looking at two trails.
Mm-hmm.
And we're looking at one on a ridge and one on in a gully, so it's maybe not comparable, but...
Right.
Anyway, it felt a lot different, the two, for the vegetation and...
It did.
The soil.
Yes, I agree. I agree. So, excellent days.
Lots of British soldier lichen on the west side.
Yeah.
Which we didn't see on the east for some reason.
And a lot more moss on the east side.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what were those rocks you mentioned? Like there were some rocks that you noticed?
Yeah, so we came across this green... Oh, mica. There's some mica on off of the Pynchon Trail.
Yeah.
When we were coming up, I could see the mica. I actually showed you some.
Yeah, and then that's why I was wondering. Where did you learn to recognize the mica?
Well, we had graduate student geologists come into our class. There were 12 of them, and they went over rocks for a day, and they were showing us different things, and I was like, oh, that's what that is. And I'm like, so what would you find in this area of North Carolina? And then, of course, they were like, I don't know, I'm from Tennessee.
Right.
But a wonderful group. To work with, and they were showing us different rock types. Although we did come across this green rock that almost shone like a metallic in the sun.
It
was very beautiful. Yeah. I don't know what it was, but it had a beautiful green hue to it.
We have a mineral book somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
The other thing that I found interesting was how looking at the topographic map and being across the river from the south, at first we couldn't tell what was what, but when we got close to where the prow was, we could tell exactly where it was.
Right, and you were also using compass to verify what we were seeing.
Right. But for the first time, we knew why it was called the prow.
Yes.
And that thing looks amazing.
Mm-hmm.
We have got to climb that someday. Mm-hmm.
We really do. So,
it's funny because people that climb, it's like a tiny little thing. It's not really hard. But for us, it'd be just an amazing climb.
Right. Because it would take an entire day to climb that for us.
And the exposure looks phenomenal. Like some of the stuff we had at... you know, the best we've ever had was at Moore's Wall.
Mm-hmm.
At, it's a park?
Hanging Rock.
Hanging Rock State Park, yep.
So, Pat and I like to climb. And we climb only at our level.
Yep.
And our level depends on a lot of things.
Below our level.
And below our level, yeah.
Doing.
Definitely.
At or above our level if we're top roping.
Right.
Way below our level if we're lead.
Lead climbing, right.
Or what do they call it when you put in stuff?
Aid climbing.
Aid climbing, I guess, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
Yeah. So, just so to give background about our climbing.
It's just a lot of fun.
It is. We love the outdoors, and it's just a fantastic way to be outdoors and do something different.
Yeah, it got me interested in the different rock types again.
Right. You know. And actually, one of the catalysts to make us get into climbing was it was a cool sport that we thought the boys would do with us, our
sons.
You
thought it was a cool sport. I thought it was stupid. Took you a long time to convince me. But yeah.
Took me several years, but I worked on them.
Yeah.
And what do we have this weekend? But we're planning a hike to or a climb at Pilot Mountain top roping.
Yep.
And I was Skyping with Luke, and Luke's like, hey, I'm in. I'm going to come up. I'm going to go out with you guys. So definitely a great way to be out with family.
Yep. Okay, so that's your blog.
That's my blog.
So topics of interest. Do we do science-y type stuff, tech-type stuff? What do we do first?
How about we start with the tech-type stuff?
Oh, that's backwards from the way I have it. Okay.
Oh, okay.
No, that's good. So techie-type stuff.
Techie-type stuff. Well, today, Patrick and I were up at 4:30 and showered and out the door and at school, at the school I teach at, in my classroom by 5:30.
Desperately trying to get Raspberry Pis working.
Trying to get Raspberry Pis set up and working. So when the students came to the enrichment time, they had some great Pis to use, some working Pis to use, which is always important. And,
So we have three over there. During the maker space, did you only have two working?
We only had two working.
But that's just because you're missing a cable.
Right. It was because of a missing cable. So I'll get the cable going. So we have three. So we had two working Pis and students standing double rows behind the people working on the Pis. And
sounded amazing.
It was very exciting.
I wish I'd been there.
Because they were taking turns sitting down and trying new things. So someone would get on and do a game. And they found a way in like, you know, the 30-minute time that they were on it to get on this game and play together on this.
With two different Pis?
So they must have the two Pis.
So did your tech guy put them on the network?
Put them on the network, and I think they could see each other.
Very cool. You should definitely be able to do that.
Really excited about that, because that was one of my concerns, that they wouldn't be able to have the Pis talk to each other.
Right.
So that was exciting. The students today,
go ahead.
Oh, they were just having a lot of fun. And in fact, I was trying to get pictures of them madly, because I have to finish up the grant by Saturday this weekend.
That's what I was going to ask about, is did you get them to write their thank yous?
I didn't put out any equipment until they had their thank yous written. I bought Pop Rock candy to give them after they wrote. And they wrote fantastic letters.
Really?
Yeah.
They were cool.
So the letters were from the heart. They were not beautiful. Because they were a bunch of eighth grade boys, one girl, and the girl that was there was not, you know, an artsy, you know, girl. She's like totally into the tech. And it was good though. I hope the people who get them on Donors Choose realize that they're coming from the kids. They did not drop in many pictures, but they were excited.
Well, that's good.
So I definitely got great letters, I think. So that's the news from the school, and very exciting to see kids just exploring technology. And one student brought in his flashlight that he rebuilt.
Uh-huh.
And
I remember that.
Yeah. So he's very excited.
How did that come out?
Perfect. It works better than it ever did. And I'm like, whoa, you have it all set. He goes, yeah, this one's yours. So you have like six of them back there. He was in the back room with me once. He noticed there's a lot more. He goes, how old are they? I said, about 10 years old. They've been here at least as long as I've been here. He goes, do you think I could buy them with CBGBs, which is this little dollar money that the kids can earn for being really good?
Yeah.
And so I had him buy one from me for 10 CBGBs. It was fun. He was excited. He left very happy.
He basically took out the regular bulb and put in an LED and a resistor.
Yep. And got everything set.
Very cool.
Yeah. just, and it was a very simple setup.
Yeah.
He's like, I just did it with what I had at home. I was playing around. So this is what he likes to do.
Yeah, that's great. In eighth
remodel.
Grade.
And I, well, no, he's a seventh grader.
Seventh grader.
So I'll have him next year. So exciting to see the techies coming up through.
Is that it for the school stuff?
That's it for the school stuff.
Well, so then before we leave the school stuff, I was going to ask you, during the, I think it was the podcast number 6 that you'd mentioned iNaturalist.
Yes, I did.
Did
so,
you guys get to do more for that?
We, because it was raining off and on, and I needed the thank you cards today, I canned the iNaturalist, like going out to get pictures. But they'll be going out on Saturday because we're supposed to have better weather.
Okay. This will be after, because this Saturday we're doing the makerspace.
Right. Yeah. And that's my group that does right. it too.
So they, it'll be after that.
It's with those. That
oh,
group.
It's with that.
Yeah. Some of the kids like to go out and get pictures.
Gotcha.
And not only that, I'm excited about this. So I realized I got this great grant for cameras. I got the cameras. And what I intended to use the cameras for, like iNaturalist, I ran out of time for because of losing 2 weeks of on and off snow days.
Yeah, right, right.
And so then I have a much tighter amount of time to work with for the curriculum. So I started sharing the cameras out with teachers, like the yearbook teacher who has finished up the yearbook. And she is excited to take the kids out to take pictures and to post them on iNaturalist. And then I also talked to the special needs teacher, and she has a student that is also going out to take pictures. And being outdoors is his best place to be. When he's inside, he gets in trouble all the time because of not being able to just conform to an indoor environment, but he can slow down and take pictures outside, and so that's what he's going to do. So very excited that that will work out for them as well.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Yeah, so it's having a bigger effect on the school than I thought, and I'm sharing it out with as many teachers as I can, which is always exciting, and everyone's really happy and thankful to be able to do that.
Oh, that sounds good.
Mm-hmm.
So,
oh.
More techie stuff?
More techie stuff. You know, we never talked about the Raspberry Pi 2.
We didn't.
And I pulled it up because
so
I'm
here's
like,
the question.
How sad.
Here's the question. Are the ones that you have at school Pi 2s or B pluses?
B pluses.
They are B pluses for mm-hmm. sure.
Okay. They are, definitely.
Well, the Pi 2 really looks like the power that it has is really phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
Makes me want to get one just to test out.
It does. And also, recently, we just read about Eben Upton in Linux Voice.
Yeah, that was, which issue was that?
That was, what issue?
Okay.
Issue 14, May 15th.
Okay.
And, great article. Very exciting about.
So he's one of the founders of the Raspberry Pi Foundation, I think?
Right.
Is that right?
Yes,
yeah.
He is.
Founder and CEO.
Right.
Yeah.
And it sounds like it's a great group that really has thought through this project.
So one of the things that really struck me from the interview is just how much work and money they put into other software projects.
Yeah.
And the way I understand it is, at one point, there was a question, there's a lot of these tiny little computers that are selling for like $60 to $100.
Mm-hmm.
And ours is $35.
Right.
So why don't we up the power a bit?
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll, you know, new chip and stuff, it'll have to be a little bit more expensive. And then at some point, he realized, no, this is not our mission. Let's just keep it and see how cheap we can make it. And they kept it at the $35 price. But, or I think they did.
Yes.
Anyway, but they kept the processor at one that was quite affordable and a slower speed. Mm-hmm. And then they did the hard work of seeing all the really critical software that runs on it. How can it be made faster? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, you're trying to get something done, you want to add a feature, and you've got a certain amount of time to do it, and you do it fast. And it means that you're not using the most optimized system.
Right.
And then suddenly you're pushed to do something else, and you just don't have time, and it's real cruft builds up in a lot of software.
Mm-hmm.
And they pared stuff down and helped, as far as I understand, they actually contributed code to open source projects that are really base projects used in the Linux system. And the whole point was to make their Raspberry Pi run fast, even though it was a slower processor. So it's funny how this entire difference in focus really made them spend time and money and energy on something that's really valuable for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
So I just loved that whole part of the interview. It was just really fantastic.
I like that. And I like that they could have made something more expensive and gone for increasing the price tag of the Pi to get the speed, but they chose not to.
Exactly. And the interesting thing is, it's not... The important thing is not that the price didn't go up. The important thing is that this mental focus on let's concentrate on what we can do to make it better.
Mm-hmm. Within this price range, within what materials we can get.
Exactly.
The other thing that I was surprised by in the article is the amount of pies that are bought for industrial use.
Oh, yeah, that's amazing.
I had no idea.
Yeah.
I'm like, wow, like a third of the pies they think are being used for industrial use.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's so easy to prototype stuff with them.
Right.
The way I understand it is a lot of projects, they could spend a lot of time trying to do something specific, or they could just buy a quick bunch of Raspberry Pis, put something together, and boom, they've got a working model, and then they can go on from that.
Right. And then what else I found interesting is it makes it that the Model B, the Model B Plus, and the Model A or A Plus, they're all still selling.
Oh, because, not only still selling, but still being produced.
Yes.
That's amazing.
Yeah, because they're supporting this huge market.
Right. Because if you have a business and you're using it.
Right.
There's going to be some latency between, you know, you finding out about the Pi 2 and being able to use it.
And
also, in the meantime, you've got a ship.
Right. And compatibility.
Right.
That was the other thing. Right. So I thought that was really interesting. I had not really thought of that particular aspect of the Pi. So that was pretty cool. Very exciting. And hopefully you'll be hearing about my new Pi that Patrick will be giving me for my birthday.
Oh, is that it?
That's it. Yeah.
Ah, okay.
My desktop.
Your desktop Pi. Yeah, I'm curious how that'll work as a desktop. I mean, I use them as second desktops everywhere.
Mine's going to be the first, and it's going to have, like, the best screen.
Okay.
Because my husband loves me.
That's right. That's what's going to happen.
Oh, dear. Okay. You're next.
I'm next. So we're sticking to the techie type stuff.
Okay.
So there's two things. Actually, there's three things. One of them is not really techie, but I think it's a lot of fun. The first one is just a discovery I made. I love this program called Xurnal, X-O-U-R-N-A-L.
Mm-hmm.
And it's basically a way to annotate. Well, it has a broad case use for making drawings and stuff, I guess, mm-hmm. and notes. But really, my use is to annotate PDFs.
Mm-hmm.
And I use it absolutely all the time. And I also like every so often to look at some of these lectures that the MIT OpenCourseWare puts out.
Mm-hmm.
They're calculus and physics lectures I really like. And I think, if I remember correctly, it's a while ago, the multivariate calculus was being taught by Denis Auroux. And I hadn't watched in a while, but I really enjoyed those lectures. And just recently, I was looking. I really don't like one of the things that Xernal does. It's the way it saves what file it has to look up
mm-hmm.
to put its annotations on. And so I was looking in the source code and stuff and seeing, well, how is that done? And in downloading it, I looked at the authors and I noticed a name. And it kind of rung a bell for a while. And I didn't put it together for like 2 or 3 days, and finally I know this name, and I found it, and it's the same guy that was teaching at MIT.
Oh, neat.
Yeah, Denis Auroux. He's the main author on Xernal. I think it's something he wrote early on in his career, and he's just maintained on and off all through. I think he's at Berkeley right now for a few years. I was looking up where he was. Anyway, it was just really cool because this is a guy that I found out about from two totally different areas mm-hmm. of life. And, you know, anyway, the other kind of really short fun thing, actually, this is not really techie. It's like human type stuff, but the Humble Bundle. It is kind of techie. It's like tech combined with social.
Mm-hmm.
So they sell games mostly, which we haven't gotten any. But they sell books mm-hmm. sometimes. And the latest one we just got was the Humble Sci-Fi Book Bundle 2.
We've gotten the last two, actually.
Did we?
Yeah, because they had techie one.
They had a techie one for kids, so that was a good one.
I got it.
Yeah. I think we talked about it already.
Yeah. Oh, did we?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then they had the Post-Apocalyptic Book Bundle. We kind of skipped on that one.
That one we skipped on.
Anyway, I thought that was a fun thing. I like that type of use of.
It's a great find, and not only that, it's I don't know.
Well, no DRM,
right?
Which is just the plague of all sorts of work that wouldn't harm anybody, and mm-hmm. I mean, it's just a huge impediment to progress. I mean, from my point of view, I don't know.
Right.
So, okay. So I am going to segue our whole conversation into the science-y part very smoothly.
Okay.
The reason you know what I'm going to talk about, mm-hmm. right? So we think 3D printing is really cool.
Mm-hmm. Right?
This is an article. So it's a research article. There was not even any perspective for it. It appeared in Science on March 30th. And let me see, I'm looking at my notes here. Tomlinson was the first author, I think. Yeah, Tomlinson. The corresponding authors were Edward T. Semolsky and Joseph M. DeSimone, both of whom are at UNC Chapel Hill, which I had no idea until I wrote up my notes for this.
I was going to try to beg one to come into our makerspace. Yes,
that would be cool.
I think I might be able to. Anyway.
And they were also, one of them at least, is part of a collaborative department with NC State. And so what's this about? It's a little bit like 3D printing. So in 3D printing, basically, you have a three-dimensional model of what you're wanting to print
mm-hmm.
in a computer. And the computer sends it to the 3D printer one layer at a time. And you have this little nozzle that goes down and puts down this kind of a paste, I guess.
Right, this plastic, and melted plastic.
Yeah, and one layer at a time, it builds up your surface.
Or cells.
Or cells. And this is really time-consuming because mm-hmm. every spot, the nozzle has to go over it.
Right.
Okay, so they developed this system along, and it's some kind of a collaboration with a company out in California, and they call it Continuous Liquid Interface Production of 3D Objects, CLIP for short, CLIP. So with CLIP, basically, it's related to lithography. Maybe mm-hmm. it's even considered lithography. But in lithography, the way I understand it, you have a resin, mm-hmm. and you shine UV light on it, and it cures it. And one of the huge problems is having oxygen around.
Right.
Because if you have oxygen, it gets into the resin, and it uses up. It quenches some of the reaction, I guess, so it can't react. But they used it to their advantage. So with their system, they have a tub filled with resin. And underneath the tub, there's a membrane which is permeable. Well, it's not underneath the tub. The bottom of the tub is a membrane. It's a kind of Teflon, the way I understand it. And it's permeable to both ultraviolet light and oxygen. Mm-hmm. And the lower surface of some kind into the tub. And they bring it down close to this window. Mm-hmm. Now, what happens is that because oxygen is diffusing through the window, there's an area close to the window where the resin will not polymerize, even if you shine UV light on it. But as you get away from the window, the oxygen concentration drops and it will polymerize. Mm-hmm. And so they take UV light controlled by a computer mm-hmm. and shine it up through the window in a pattern that matches the first layer. Mm-hmm. And the entire thing polymerizes all at once. And it polymerizes...
So layer by layer.
Yeah, and it polymerizes as a layer. Mm-hmm. So you send it as one layer, like you would a 3D printer, and it mm-hmm. polymerizes at one layer onto this surface that they put down. And then they raise the surface. And then they send light that matches the next layer. Mm-hmm. And raise it again, and it keeps polymerizing. And it looks really cool.
So much faster process?
It's much faster process.
And, you know, it seems like it would be instead of putting the individual drops.
Yeah, So I'm curious to see how long it'll be before you start seeing this all over the place. And it's supposed to be a lot cheaper, too.
Oh, wonderful. So, yeah.
Much neat. Finer control also, supposedly. Mm-hmm. Well, so it's interesting. The control of the resolution is related to different things, right? Mm-hmm. For a 3D printer, basically your nozzle and the characteristics of the plastic you're using are going to determine your resolution. With this, the resolution is related more to how fast you pull up the plate. And there's a few other things that go into it. And they had some interesting graphs in the paper.
Yeah.
And anyway. Neat. So, yeah, I thought that was really neat.
That's really cool.
Okay. So.
So another thing that I found out about today is the 3D print pen.
Yeah.
And so, you use the pen to draw in 3D.
So basically, it's extruding the same kind of plastic as the printer.
Exactly.
It heats it up.
Right.
But instead of having a 3D printer do it.
You're doing it.
You're doing it by hand.
Right.
So it's like an artsy type.
Right.
That's kind of cool.
I thought it was kind of cool.
Yeah.
I found out about it today and I thought, oh, well, now that you're 3D printing, I'll talk about my 3D pen.
Yeah.
Anyway, very reasonably priced and might be something fun to play with.
Yep. Yep. Okay. Anything that you have or you want, did you want to, I see you have insects and stuff up on your computer. And
actually, dice I was going to this is last week's, I was going to go over to oceans. I thought we could both talk a little bit about oceans.
Okay. So is this because of the deep water horizons?
Yes. So I thought we could start with yours.
Maybe I'll start. Yeah, because mine is more general.
Right.
So, well, no, maybe it's the other way. But, okay, well, so what is this? There was an article in a recent Science going over findings that are coming out of the research done in the Gulf following the Deep Horizons oil spill that happened, was it 5 years ago? I think it was 5 years ago.
5 years ago.
Which, I mean, it's pretty much the worst spill we've had in North America, possibly in the world. I don't know. I remember a lot earlier the Exxon Valdez, and they were saying that it was, I don't know, entire Exxon Valdez spills every 3 days or something.
Right.
Or 17 days. Or
incredible.
I'm not sure if that's actually the numbers, but it was something like that. Anyway, it looks like they're finding out a lot of interesting stuff from the research that's being done. Some types of communities are rebounding that we didn't think would. The most easy to see is the brown pelican. There were these horrible images of them all booed up and dying.
And they've returned.
And as far as we can tell, the population is pretty much the same as it was before.
Oh, so that's incredible.
The insects in certain areas have been hit really badly, and they're thinking that's going to have a long-term effect on the food chains.
Oh, definitely.
There was a lady that was doing some research on ant colonies and other insects, and these ants, I can't remember what they're called, but they live over a large area of marsh. Like, they form this colony colony over a large area. And in this area, like, I think several meters, the colony inhabits curled up or the centers of reeds, marsh grasses that are curled up.
Yeah.
So it's kind of dispersed in a way, but it's all one colony. And the colonies, if I remember correctly, would form in the spring. And and she compared ones that were in areas that were heavily gooed up with oil in the past, and I mean, you know, during the spill, to ones that were that had escaped, and found the colonies would show up, and then by the end of summer they'd all disappeared.
And so they weren't able to sustain themselves?
No, and they're not sure why, but there's some clues. So one thing is, I guess she was collecting them and found their heads were smaller. And for ants, that's a sign of malnourishment. Anyway, that's the measurement.
Oh, wow.
And when she's thinking, they were digging up some soil that looked normal, but you look underneath and it's just totally black. And you can crack it open.
Oh, wow.
And one possibility is that in the summer, these mudflats dry up. And stuff that had that's become hard and basically has taken itself out of the natural environment cracks open. And then all of the stuff that's inside now that's more volatile gets exposed to the air again. And then comes up and it's toxic.
Right.
And then it kills the insects. And so the two things that I remember is that may explain the ants' disappearance every year is that it's that this cracking open of this buried oil deposits from the oil spill is killing the insects they feed on. Because the ants, these types of ants feed on insects basically. And so they're starving. The other possibility is she had some in the lab, I think, and found out that they wouldn't come down from the reeds if there was these certain types of fumes in the air.
Got it.
So they might actually be starving themselves, because when those toxic fumes come up, they stop hunting. They just stay up, which protects them, but they starve to death.
Right.
Because they can't get to other insects. Okay. Anyway, so, but lots of very interesting research coming out of that whole thing.
Interesting.
Now, you looked at the immersion, dispersion type stuff?
So I looked at spraying dispersants.
Dispersants, gotcha.
When you have a deep oil spill. Yeah. And so there's these two researchers that looked at dispersants. One is named, let me see, Claire Paris, and she's out of the University of Miami. And she's working with Zachary Amen out of the Western Australia. And what they think is that when you get a certain size of oil, that dispersants, or when you have dispersants, are not necessary if you have certain pressure and water movement, because those droplets, when they're put down to smaller droplets and make a cloud, they stay within the water and they don't rise to the surface.
Yeah, a lot of the oil never rose to the surface, just coated the bottom.
Right. And so they're saying, like, you know, the dispersants weren't efficient in dealing with the issue. And so probably not necessary to use. And so they did some tests with some high-speed blenders and came up with this idea. And Dr. Amen, he worked at setting up models to set up pressure with depth and that to kind showcase it.
Yeah, I remember some people saying that at deep water horizon, the pressure differential was so great, it was gushing out so forcefully through that narrow opening that was enough to cause it to disperse.
And that's what they're saying. Just that.
Because of the pressure.
Right, that pressure. Flow. And the dispersants at that point weren't going to do
any more. They weren't
going to
do any more than
what was being done. So it wasn't necessary. Although there are other people that are skeptics about what is going on. So it's caused a whole group of researchers to dig back into it and try to figure out, are these like, should we be reconsidering what kinds of situations we use them in, and if at all we should be using them. And so we have some labs in the United States, Canada, and Germany trying to test dispersants in more typical conditions.
Yeah.
And so that they would be able to kind of measure how well they're working instead of a blender.
Did they talk about possible toxicities of dispersants at all?
No, these, not in this particular article. They looked at more of, you know, the droplet size and the actual function of a dispersant.
Right.
They did not look at the toxicity.
Yeah.
So I found it kind of interesting to look at it as more of a, you know, physics point of view and think through it that way. And now it makes me want to go back and dig into, okay, so what is the toxicity caused by this particular chemical being used in an oil spill beyond the oil, and trying to work through that.
So this reminds me of another part of the Deep Horizon research. I guess after the spill, the erosion at the marsh, which was already bad, just skyrocketed.
Oh, that's strange.
And one of the things they're thinking, which is an interesting possible cause, is that some bacteria... Actually, some bacteria were hurt by the spill, but some were helped, and especially ones that like to feed on hydrocarbons.
Mm-hmm.
And some of those also feed on the muck that's underneath the grasses, all that organic material. And so these bacterial populations possibly have really increased And that the organic material in the muck of the marsh is what holds it together.
Oh, and so it's been broken down even further.
So now it's being broken down a lot faster.
So it's like
faster.
The matrix has been removed from what holds
exactly,
it.
Oh,
okay,
exactly.
Okay, got it.
Only, you know, not sure whether that's really the case. Mm-hmm. Certainly many other factors are involved with erosion. But it's an interesting connection there mm-hmm. with bacteria.
Neat.
Okay. Let's see. I don't know. We had CRISPR down to talk about again. Mm-hmm. Not to talk about the technicalities at all, but just there's been like letter after letter and editorial after editorial from scientists saying mm-hmm. We really better be careful about what we're doing because of germline modification
right
being permanent
right
in humans. You don't want to create people that, you know, it's going to be with them and with their children and
mm-hmm.
So I think, and I mean, the way I understand it, there's rumors that someone's already done some experiments on germline cells, and
right.
as far as I understand, not with any plans to take it any further, but just to understand
mm-hmm.
Certain mechanisms having to do with, well, with the cells at that stage. I mean, there's many interesting questions. I don't know what they were researching, and I don't even know if this was done or not. This is just rumor, but
right.
I think that worried a lot of people, those rumors.
Right.
And and I find it interesting because usually you have the public mm-hmm. that kind of leads the way about, you know, with some fear of science, which I find personally irrational a lot of times.
Mm-hmm.
But in this case, the public is just not aware this is happening at all, as far as I can tell.
Right.
But, well, one of the things got published, one of the scientists' letters, you know, group of scientists that got together, I think it got published in a major newspaper, like a, not a scientific journal.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I'll have to look it up.
Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds interesting.
But there was several in science. There was at least one in Nature, and the ones mm-hmm. in Nature called for a moratorium mm-hmm. on all germline research with Dicer. Anyway, it's really interesting that it's the scientists that are part of the field this time that are mm-hmm. saying, whoa, this is kind of scary. let's see. Are you finding it? I don't know if it was in the, I don't know, New York Times or something.
Okay.
Can't remember.
Yeah, but it definitely, it'll be interesting to see how this discussion goes on.
Yeah.
And just, I'm hoping people will be really thoughtful about it and,
Well, it's tricky. There's a lot of really interesting questions that I'm sure that's the way to address them is by germline modification.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of questions. The way I understand it, one of the big ones is about fertility.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some of those questions could be answered by modifying the germline cells and seeing how, you know, whether you get fertilization or not, I guess, and how they develop after that point.
So, right. Wow.
Anyway, you know, this is all I have, right, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, and so that's all I have right now.
With just over an hour?
Yep.
So I thought this was going to go on a lot longer, but just, you know, for one thing, I'd like to have, like, numbers to talk about so it can,
right,
because I like
exactly.
the technical part, but we've been so incredibly busy.
Yeah,
I'm just happy that we were able to keep up.
I know, so. I agree. So future plans,
well, we have the climb mm-hmm. which is not techie, but there's a lot of tech involved, which we can talk about.
And, right.
You know, the kilonewtons that get applied during falls and stuff like that is really right. interesting. Manufacturing processes and
right.
how those... So I.
And also just a checklist that we have to go through to prepare, which...
Yeah, how your mental
yeah.
processes, the psychology.
Right.
And also the nature over there, you know, the rocks and stuff. Mm-hmm. So that'll be interesting. I'm really looking forward to that.
I am too.
So, and then Makerspace this Saturday.
Yes, Patrick's coming in again.
Yep.
An encore appearance to help students set up a camera.
What else?
And I think
we should get back to
our transmitters. Our park boards.
Park boards?
Or the
Osh park boards.
Osh
boards.
Yeah.
Right. And with keeping an eye on ARDF transmitters and
right.
and practicing with those and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
And, yeah. So I'm kind of thinking that we're definitely going to get back to the Osh park boards soon, but very quickly I'm going to transition to, okay, let's do some tests with what we have.
Right.
And
let's get a working
yeah.
unit so we can
and
go
maybe
out.
Another year we'll build enough to actually put on an event, but this mm-hmm. year it's just going to be too much.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so I guess we are wrapping this up. Is that
yeah. okay?
So do you have any other future plans?
No, it's everything.
Okay, so... Thank you for listening to the Frontal Harvest podcast.
Make sure you check out our blog.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.